This is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Sitting in for Dr. Mohler today, Russell Moore. Dr. Moore is Dean of the School of Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Now, here's your host for today, Dr. Russell Moore.
Not really your host for today. This is Russell Moore just sitting in for a few minutes because I want to talk to you before Dr. Mohler comes on, or at least the disembodied voice of Dr. Mohler. It's what in the radio lingo is called a classic broadcast of the Albert Mohler program. That's one of those broadcasts that was meaningful enough in terms of the way that people are continuing to talk about it that we want you to hear it again. We want you to think about some of the issues that Dr. Mohler talked about previously that are still coming up, and indeed coming up in some new ways, so that we can talk about it some more. And it's the issue of the way that people shift and change on the issue of abortion. Dr. Mohler talked not long ago about, back in January of this year, about the way that so many of the people that we're accustomed to seeing as pro-abortion rights or pro-choice, if that's the lingo that you use, politicians were previously strongly pro-life or anti-abortion, including some names that you might not expect, like Ted Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, Al Gore, all at one time were strongly articulating a pro-life position on the abortion issue, and Dr. Mohler talks in this broadcast about why that is. Now, I've kind of seen this up close as somebody who used to be really active in Democratic politics as a pro-life Democrat, worked for a stalwart pro-life Democratic United States congressman who is still stalwartly pro-life, and I'm proud of him and thankful to God for him, but he is in a very shrinking minority. It seems that the abortion issue tends to, over time, as Dr. Mohler is going to mention, move left, especially since you have some very, very powerful constituencies out there who are saying to people, if you want to have a future as a national Democratic candidate, then you need to be a pro-abortion rights candidate, which is why sometimes you'll have people who are elected to office at the local level or at the state level who are pro-life. But as they start growing in office, as they start moving toward greater and greater aspirations, as they start having to ask people for money, there's the temptation to abandon that for a pro-abortion rights position. Now, what I'd like to say is that is not only a tendency in the Democratic Party, although it's greater there right now. But you hear people all the time right now in the Republican Party saying if we're going to reach a broader base, if we're going to reach a greater niche among the American people, then we need to relax our concern for the sanctity of human life and at least be open to things like experimenting on embryonic stem cells. Or give up talking about a legal solution to the abortion problem, and instead let's just talk about ways to reduce abortions. Now, the reason why this is so important is that when Dr. Mohler is going to be talking in a few minutes about the pattern, and that's really what's key here, is the fact that there is a pattern. How the Kennedy family moved from a pro-life Irish Catholic family to a very, very radically pro-abortion political family. How does that happen? Well, it happens in the same way that any Christian or any church or any community, any group of people, any family can move on any issue. You first start by examining your convictions in light of how they're playing in the public arena, which is what is so dangerous about politics in and of itself. In the political arena, you obviously are seeking to lead people toward your convictions, but you can't lead people too far ahead without becoming a martyr. And so you're always seeking the art of compromise. That's natural and that's normal. That's the art of politics. But there are some issues that cannot be compromised. There are some issues that are so fundamental to who you are and to how you are being shaped and formed into the kind of person and the kind of country that you want to be, that giving them up really shows a weakness of character. Honestly, I would almost rather see a candidate who had been supportive of abortion rights from the very beginning, never had any illusions in his mind or her mind about whether or not innocent human life ought to be protected, than to see somebody who understands and knows this is a child. I mean, you think about the way that Jesse Jackson could speak about an unborn child and the fact that an unborn child shouldn't be killed. The way that Al Gore would say, for instance, in 1988, I am not in favor of funding abortion. What is, as he puts it, arguably the taking of a human life. How you move from that stance to a pro-abortion rights stance, it makes me wonder what else you're able to negotiate, what else you're able to give up on something that is such a gut-level human rights issue. But people can do it, and people can convince themselves that they're doing the right thing, and you see that kind of talk all over the place, even among evangelical Christians who would say, I'm pro-life. But let me tell you where you see that pattern happening. When you hear someone speaking to you right now who will say, I'm pro-life, but I don't think that we're going to be able to win this one long term. Or I'm pro-life, but I think that there are many other issues that we ought to be considering. Or I'm pro-life, but I think that we need to take into account the realities that we see around us. You see someone who is already moving in this pattern of cultural accommodation, and more importantly than in the political arena, you can see the exact same thing happening in churches, in which the stakes are much higher than they are on Capitol Hill or in your local state house, in which you have people who are saying it's not so much that we're going to give up an issue, whatever the issue is, whether the issue is abortion or whether the issue is divorce or whether the issue is any number of things about honoring people and following Christ and loving God and loving neighbor. The first step is not to give up your convictions on these things. The first step is to stop talking about them. The first step is actually, even before you stop talking about it, to start nervously looking around you and apologizing. And so it's very easy for some of us to look at some of these political figures and say, look at how you have changed and look at how you have moved. But what about how many of us in our churches who are really, really squeamish when it comes to, for instance, speaking about the exclusivity of Jesus Christ for salvation? And even if we say Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by Him, we're kind of looking around and apologizing for it. I don't mean to say this, but we kind of have to. The next step is simply not to speak in those terms. I heard a pastor one time who stood up and said to his congregation, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. One cometh unto the Father by me. That's not what Jesus says in John 14. That's true. But what the pastor, it seems, is trying to do is to keep from offending people with an exclusive message of that no one comes to the Father except through me with a little bit more palatable answer. Same thing can happen on virtually any issue that God has spoken to in the Word of God. If you start not speaking about it, then the culture is going to fill that in. And people are going to have their minds shaped, as Paul says to the church at Rome in Romans chapter 12, they're going to have their minds being shaped and fitted toward the patterns of this age, the patterns of this world. People are thinking in that way. So just like 60 years ago, if you are not teaching and preaching and instructing one another on racial equality, and on the fact that all people are made in the image of God, then depending on where you are, the cultural understanding of the superiority of one race or the other is going to flow in. Same thing's happening right now when it comes to honoring babies. So that the issue is not just that you are becoming more and more politically attuned to the way that the political culture sees babies, but you're becoming more and more culturally attuned to not seeing this as a blessing and not seeing this as a gift. It could be that your church or your community or your family is long away from becoming a Ted Kennedy pro-abortion rights type of advocate. But it could be that you're just becoming very, very numb to the suffering of people. Or you're becoming very, very callous to the goodness and blessings of life. When you see that start happening, you're moving. And when you're moving, you need to ask, why am I moving and where am I going? Dr. Moeller is going to be back in a few minutes, and he's going to talk about how you can see this shift of formerly pro-life politicians who are now pro-abortion rights, and what does that mean for where the country is headed? What does it mean for you? This is Russell Moore sitting in for Albert Moeller. This is the Albert Moeller Program, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Moeller on the issues of life and change.
This is the best of the Albert Moeller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. I have to tell you, in last week's Wall Street Journal in particular, in a story that I read at the very end of the week, I saw an example of the best kind of journalism. It's a story that was published dated the January 1, 2009 date of the Wall Street Journal. The title of the article was How Support for Abortion Became Kennedy Dogma, and it has to do with the opening about the fact that, of course, Caroline Kennedy, who is likely perhaps to become the next Kennedy senator, that she has certainly affirmed in very unwavering terms her support for abortion. No expectation of surprise there, because after all, that's the dogma of the Democratic Party, and it's the dogma of the Kennedy family. But it wasn't always so. And I knew the story in general terms, but I did not know the particulars. Anne Hendershot, who is professor of urban studies at the King's College in New York City, formerly taught at the University of San Diego, has written a fascinating book, The Politics of Abortion. And she wrote the article that I cited in my article at albertmoeller.com. She wrote the article in the Wall Street Journal. And she talks about, some background information that I find not only fascinating, but instructive, even chilling. Anne Hendershot's my guest today on the Albert Moeller Program. Professor Hendershot, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Moeller. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, thank you for that article. I was just talking with another person who deals with Christian ethics this afternoon, and we were just talking about how thankful we are that you wrote and that the Wall Street Journal published that article. It's just a stellar piece.
Oh, well, I'm grateful you posted it on your blog, and I appreciated what you said about it, because the warning that you kind of give to other theologians is a warning that I wish more Catholic theologians and Protestant Catholic theologians should take to heart, because they can be very powerful, and that's what the piece is about, how Catholic priests and theologians really convinced the Kennedys that they could support abortion with a clear conscience.
Now, in your book, The Politics of Abortion, you have a more extended explanation of this. I'm reading from page 10 here, and I just want to set it up for you to explain it. You write, in a long-forgotten meeting at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, on a hot summer day in 1964, the Kennedy family and their advisors and allies were coached by leading theologians and Catholic college professors to accept and promote abortion with, quote, a clear conscience, end quote. How did that happen, and what happened in that meeting?
Well, we know all about it. We know the particulars because a former Jesuit priest by the name of Albert Johnson wrote a book, and just in 1998, and it was called The Birth of Bioethics. He kind of thinks of himself as the father of bioethics. And he was really bragging about it. And I don't know that the Kennedys were so happy with him doing that, but he really felt like a very powerful man because he was called to the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport and brags about how he was sitting on the oceanside terrace of Bobby Kennedy's home in Hyannisport, convincing him that he could support abortion. But Bobby Kennedy was part of the conspiracy because he wanted to run for senator in New York. And in 1964, abortion was a hot topic in New York. It was legalized in New York way before Roe v. Wade. So Bobby Kennedy wanted to run for senator, and he wanted to have some theological cover, is what I call it. It's hard for me to say this because I love the Catholic Church. They have some wonderful people, but they made a very big mistake in the 60s, and there were a number of Jesuits at that meeting, most of them college professors, who convinced him that, well, they took the argument from Father John Courtney Murray's position that said that, you know, this separation of church and state, that in order to get along, that it would, if you repress this new law, it could lead to greater perils in social peace and justice. So they took the social justice tack that women would die from illegal abortion, so we have to provide this.
You know, I've read John Courtney Murray. I haven't read everything, but I've read all of his major works. And frankly, I disagree with the direction he takes. I'm not a Catholic, so this is not an intramural discussion. But quite frankly, it explained to me how John F. Kennedy could take the approach he took in 1960, speaking to the Houston Baptist Pastors Association.
Isn't that a disaster?
But it seems to me that that's where you have the divergence, where you come up with the idea that, yes, I'm a believer, but I don't have to apply those convictions to my public life. Once you get there, then it's pretty easy, in one sense, to get to what happened in 1964. But what's chilling to me is how there were so many willing theological accomplices here. And some of these names, these names are well known to me. Robert Drynan, who later became a congressman until the Pope required all Catholics to leave elective office. He was followed, by the way, by his chosen successor, Barney Frank, there in Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, I know, because I think Barney Frank's brother or something worked in Drynan's office.
Yeah, it's a really convoluted thing.
Drynan was one of the most pro-abortion senators from Massachusetts, even before Roe v. Wade, and he supported every form of abortion, including partial birth abortion. Yeah, it's an embarrassment for the Catholic Church, I think. But, I mean, we still have these problems today because there are still a number of Catholics who believe that you can still be a good Catholic and support abortion. I mean, even Nancy Pelosi said that she thinks it's kind of geographical, as if God's word changes by geography. But that's pretty much what she was saying.
Well, but she also managed to stick her foot in her mouth theologically by accusing Augustine of believing something he never believed or taught and completely misconstruing the moral history of abortion in her own church. But, you know, the lessons here certainly are directed towards an event that that concerned Catholics. And one of them, for instance, Charles Curran, who was removed from his position at the Catholic University of America because of his teachings that violated the magisterial authority of the church, and in particular on the question of abortion as well as papal authority. But as an evangelical, I have to tell you, Professor Hendershot, this is really close to home, because this is what happens when theologians become accomplices to the sellout of their own faith. And unfortunately, that happens in more cases than we would ever like to imagine. It happens. Mainline Protestantism was basically taken into a liberal trajectory by its theologians. It wasn't the people. In fact, the people in the pews of those churches even now are far more conservative than those who are teaching in their seminaries. And so, to me, it just seems that this particular meeting really underlines in a very graphic way what's at stake, because I don't think it's too much of an argument to say that that meeting led, in terms of a direct line of the Kennedy family participation, to the death of unborn human beings.
Oh, I think it's had long. I think you're right, absolutely right, Dr. Mueller. And that's the saddest part of all, that really the Catholic clergy we can thank for bringing us abortion on demand in large part. And that's horrible to have to say that. But, I mean, it continues in other denominations, but they really played a role, an important role. Senator Ted Kennedy was himself pro-life, or at least he said he was pro-life, even into the 70s. 1971, he was still, there's a letter I have posted on the Internet where he wrote a constituent saying how he respects life from the moment of conception. That's 1971. He didn't have to be pro-choice because he was not in New York. His brother had to be pro-choice because he was in New York. But Massachusetts people, like you said, the people in the pews, were still very strongly, strongly pro-life. And so he didn't want to be pro-choice because he wouldn't have been reelected.
Well, I mentioned in my article the names Al Gore and Jesse Jackson, just as who are neither of whom is Catholic. Al Gore being a Baptist and Jesse Jackson being a Baptist as well in a different denomination. Both of them were once solidly pro-life. Al Gore ran for the Congress and the Senate from Tennessee as a solid pro-life supporter. Jesse Jackson once went so far as to write an article published, I believe, in Sojourners magazine, in which he argued that one of the signs of racism in America was the annihilation of unborn black babies and the scourge of abortion. But when both of them decided to run for president, they changed their position. And clearly, even by their own admission, it was no coincidence. When we come back, I'm going to ask Professor Ann Hendershot to talk about another link, and that is when feminism became pro-abortion. That's a story you need to hear as well. We'll be right back on the Albert Mueller Program.
the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Ann Hendershot, Professor of Urban Studies at the King's College in Manhattan, a fascinating college, meets in the Empire State Building. Fascinating outpost there for evangelical scholarship, and very proud that it's there. Proud to have Ann Hendershot on the program today. She's the author of an outstanding book entitled The Politics of Abortion. And Professor Hendershot, you know, this is a story that I think I know pretty well, but I have to tell you, you added some material and some background that I found absolutely fascinating to my knowledge of some of the connections here. One of the things you demonstrate in your book is what I'd like to ask you about right now, and that is you make the very clear case that feminism was not tied to the abortion rights movement until political expediency brought the two together. Can you tell us that story?
That's true. I mean, the earliest feminists, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were very much pro-life, and they found they thought that those were the very earliest. But even Betty Friedan in the 60s, the feminine mystique, which is really the Bible of feminists, not a word really about abortion. It was not an issue. But there was money to be made in the abortion industry. Two men, Larry Leder and Bernard Nathanson. Nathanson later recanted and had a conversion experience and now has Jesus in his life. So he has told us really what happened in these early days. He regrets his role in bringing abortion to the masses, but he said he had to really convince feminists to jump on board. And to do that, because he knew that that would help increase the industry. There was money to be made, so there was money there. So the politicians and the moneymakers were on board before the feminists were. But once that snowball got started and women jumped aboard, there was no stopping it. And now, I mean, you kind of equate feminism with that, which is too bad because we have Feminists for Life, a really terrific organization, who says abortion, their slogan is abortion hurts women. They look at the role, you know, certainly they worry about the unborn child, but they worry about women and the after effects of abortion. But no, feminists were not part of this in the beginning, not at all.
Now, what do you think was the motivation? You mentioned money, but tie that together so that folks can understand. In what sense did the feminist movement gain by jumping upon the abortion rights bandwagon?
Well, they were convinced that in order for women to play a full role in the workforce, sort of like the Soviet ideology or the Marxist ideology, that for women needed to be released from their childbearing responsibilities. And then that goes pretty much back to Margaret Sanger days, and then we get into race issues. But they were convinced that it would be good for women to be released from these kinds of responsibilities. And birth control opened the door for that, to be able to choose, you know, when to have a child. And then once that door was opened, women jumped aboard, and they had plenty of help. You had these groups, once again, Catholic group. I wouldn't call them Catholic, but Catholics for a Free Choice, which sees itself under the leadership then of Frances Kissling, who really saw herself as a feminist, but also had such hatred for the Catholic Church that she even said she wanted to overthrow the Church. So that you have this intertwining between the Democratic Party, the Church, and the people who hate religion and hate the Church, and women who become convinced that in order for women to play a full role in the workforce, they need to have this access to abortion.
Yeah, you know, I've read so many of the feminists on this, and one of the points they make is that men are not constrained biologically in terms of their career path and career options,
right,
because they don't get pregnant. So in order to be equal, a woman has to have the ability to eliminate the, quote, threat of a pregnancy to her career. You know, I just find that to be such tragic language, but it is clear that when you look at the...
You should be the writer here, Dr. Mueller. That's exactly what I would have liked to have said. That's a terrific way to put it. That's exactly what it was about.
Well, I got to tell you, I just hope more people would read your book. And the book, again, is entitled The Politics of Abortion. The author is Ann Hendershot at King's College, the King's College there in New York City. Professor Hendershot, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Mullen.
And I'm, by the way, looking forward to her new book, which I've just seen announced, on how Catholic education has decided to go after the adulation of the world. Because, unfortunately, once again, the evangelical parallels are all too apparent. We'll be back to take your calls on the Albert Miller program. I'd like to know what you are thinking about when you hear the story, the recounting there of that meeting, and you think about the danger of having your church's teachings sold out by those who would give politicians political cover. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Give me a call on the Albert Miller program.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler program. You know, history is fascinating just in terms of the record of what happened and the interpretation of those events, because there's always a mixture of interpretation while you understand the facts. But it is also true that the historical distance gives you a little bit of perspective that you don't have at the moment. I'm not sure that people who observed that meeting at Hyannisport in Massachusetts in 1964 would have understood the full import of what was happening. But in retrospect, we sure can now. And what you had there was a graphic depiction of what happens when theologians and priests or pastors sell out their own church in order to create political cover for politicians. The issue of abortion is probably the clearest example, but it's not the only example. We have it now on homosexuality and any number of other issues. And the argument that's being used there all the way back to 1964 was this. Look, the separation of church and state means that you have a private conviction and a public responsibility, and they do not have to be tied together. In other words, you can say, as for instance, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo said in a very infamous address given at the University of Notre Dame in 1984, he said, I am personally pro-life, but as governor, I defend abortion rights. And so you say, well, that looks like a gross disconnect, and that would be because you have common sense. But when you start using this argument that there are private convictions and then there are public responsibilities and the two do not have to be consistent, then you can go in any number of directions you want. You can say, I believe that homosexuality is a sin. However, I am going to support the right of persons to marry someone of the same sex. And so you have that. So on the issue of abortion, the issue, of course, is life. And so a lot of people would think that where the argument began that would convince people to go from pro-life to pro-choice in orientation and in voting, a lot of people would think that the argument would, first of all, have centered on, for instance, whether or not the fetus is genuinely human. And, you know, one thing I find fascinating is that that is not where that argument began, because just as abortion itself wasn't even controversial or talked about before, say, the early 1960s, even in that discussion, the moral and ontological status, that is to say, the actual status of being of the fetus as human, was not in question. That was recognized. Only later, in terms of the kind of rethink that would take place, did people try to come up with these arguments. And by the way, we now know what we did not know at the time, and that is when Harry Blackmun, the Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, in 1973 wrote the majority opinion in the decision Roe v. Wade, he already knew where he wanted the decision to go. He was, after he made that judgment, looking for a rationale to put in his opinion, his decision. And that is just not intellectually honest. By the way, we know that not only because of his law clerks and others, we now know it because of his own daughter, Susan Blackmun, who is herself an abortion rights activist, who recounted how her father brought that conversation home to the dinner table and let the process be known. Now, Ann Hendershot, whose article in the Wall Street Journal first caught my attention and whose book, The Politics of Abortion, I think is must reading, she recounts that article in 1964, and one of the points that she makes there is that, of course, you had collusion going on. You had those who were the official teachers of the Catholic Church present in that meeting in order to enable a political family with at least two persons there headed for the Senate. One, Senator Edward Kennedy, already in the Senate since 1962, and Robert F. Kennedy, running for the Senate from New York in 1964. So you had a family here that wanted to change its position. They wanted to find a way where they would not alienate their Roman Catholic base. They would not repudiate openly the teaching of their church in such a way that the church would take punitive action, but that they would make this bifurcation, this separation between their private convictions and public responsibilities. Now, at my article posted at albertmuller.com, I said there are two huge lessons here, and I want to look at those lessons very closely. Number one, the first lesson is there seemed to be no shortage of theologians who will sell out their church. I put it this way. I said this: there will be theologians who seem ever ready to find a way to subvert the teachings of their church, even as they seek to remain in its employ and trust. Now, again, that is not a Catholic problem. That's a far larger problem. That's true in mainstream, what's called mainline Protestantism. That's how those denominations began to go so liberal now decades ago and are now at their elites, at the level of their leadership and seminary professors and college leadership and all the rest are thoroughly liberal. That's where it began. But among evangelicals, we have the same pattern that can be discerned and to the same effect. It's a sellout. And the second lesson is this. There will ever be politicians who are looking for political cover and will gladly receive this cover from those willing to subvert their church's teachings. Now, in this case, it was the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. The issue was abortion, and the family was Kennedy. But the reality is that there are far more denominations involved than just that, and there are countless politicians who are trying to hold to this kind of position. One of the things that I said earlier in this program is that this didn't begin in 1964 when presidential candidate John F. Kennedy spoke to the meeting of the Houston Baptist Pastors Conference. It was an associational meeting there in Houston in 1960. He said, in response to what many people were accusing him of believing as a Catholic, that even as he was a Catholic, he would not bring his Catholic convictions into the role that he would play as president. And, of course, what I wish is that on the issue of abortion, Catholic candidates held to the position of their church and defended human life, because I can find no way that I could possibly decide that on the one hand, and here's the real horror of this, let's look at what we're talking about. On the one hand, you believe that abortion is murder, and on the other hand, you believe that it has to be protected as a right? In what sane mind can murder be defined as a right? In what sane and consistent and honest mind can you say, I believe that abortion is the unwarranted, murderous, homicidal taking of an innocent human life that should have the same moral standing as any other human life? And then say, but in my public role, my public office, I'm going to support the platform of my party, and I am going to fight for and defend the right to kill unborn babies. This lesson, or these lessons, are so instructive, and when we look at this, we realize that it's not just the issue of abortion, and it's certainly not just the Roman Catholic Church. This is a process that goes on before our eyes. If we just look closely enough, we'll see the pattern. Anne Hendershot, in her article and in her book, takes us to a meeting in 1964 where, in retrospect, we now get to hear participants say what happened. I find the knowledge of that meeting absolutely chilling, but also clarifying. Back with final thoughts. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. One of the things that we face again and again is when we see changes in the society and changes in morality and changes in the culture that require some explanation. And it is our task as thinking Christians to look at these things and try to connect the dots, try to figure all of this out, because they do not happen by accident. And especially when you see organized shifts in moral behavior, something significant is going on there, and we need to be looking carefully at what's going on. Almost always, you're going to find that there is a pattern of a coalescence of persons who have similar, if not identical, purposes to bring about this change. And if you go back and start to look at the worldviews that are represented there, you'll often see that, of course, it's never just about that issue. Now, I'm saying this because if you go back to 1964 and you look at that meeting we've been discussing between liberal Catholic priests and theologians and then the Kennedy family that led to the change in the Kennedy family's position on abortion, you know, it's never just abortion. It's never just one thing. Once you accept that you can make this divide between private conviction and public office, then you can apply it, and frankly, you will apply it whenever it's convenient, to whatever moral principle or conviction or church teaching that is at stake. Now, looking at this, I think we find a very sober realization. That sober realization is this. If people in the pews of churches allow this to happen, then ultimately they become co-conspirators in this process. If we in the society simply go along with the kind of redefinition and revolution that is being talked about here that we can trace to a meeting like this and that we can see in the larger changes in the society in terms of conviction, then we are a part of the problem, not of the solution. You see, here's a bit of good news. If you go back to 1964 and you look forward and now look to 1995 and then onward to the year 2008, you're going to be surprised that the majority of presidents elected, say, between 1968 and the present have been those with pro-life convictions. You see, one of the things you will be able to detect is that the American people have not moved in lockstep with those who've tried to bring about this moral revolution. To the contrary, a good number of Americans have enough moral sense to know that if you compromise the dignity and the sanctity of life of an unborn human being, it isn't long before you necessarily discount the right to life of every single human person on the planet. So there's hope. There's hope that something like this can be confronted and analyzed, and eventually we have the hope that we can reach the hearts of the American people to recover moral sanity and the sanctity of human life, and to expect that of those who would lead them. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.